Your film is now ready to be shown.
Good morning. I'm Justin Hendricks, editor of Tech Policy Press, a nonprofit media venture intended to provoke new ideas, debate, and discussion at the intersection of technology and democracy. In 2022, the state of California enacted the Age Appropriate Design Code Act. The stated purpose of the bill was to create special safeguards for children and address concerns over the impact of the design of online products and services on their well-being. However, soon after its enactment, the trade association NetChoice, representing major online businesses including the social media platforms, sued California's Attorney General, Robert Bonta, arguing that the law violated the First Amendment, among other constitutional grounds. In September 2023, U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California Judge Beth Freeman granted a preliminary injunction in favor of NetChoice. A central question in this case revolved around whether the law's requirements compel online businesses to engage in scrutiny of speech that infringes upon their First Amendment rights. Here's California's counsel encountering this question right out of the gate from Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals Judge Milan Smith Jr. at the start of oral arguments last month.
Good morning, Your Honors. Kristen Liska on behalf of the Attorney General, and I'd like to reserve about 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'll try to keep an eye on the clock. May it please the Court. The California legislature unanimously enacted the California Age Appropriate Design Code Act to protect children and their privacy online. The legislature was motivated by documented harms to children from online companies' data and privacy practices, including addiction-like behaviors, lack of sleep, negative impact on educational attainment, exploitation, and detrimental mental health outcomes.
Counsel, I think all of us would say the objective is one that we could only laud. But we are dealing with the First Amendment here, and we have some questions about the nature of what is included in this bill. I'm going to use an abbreviation, but I want to make certain the record is clear. I'm talking about the Data Protection Impact Assessment, which is at Civil Code 1798.99.33A, as so defines. I'm going to call it the DPIA, okay? This law forces the private parties to opine what they think is material detrimental to children. How isn't that compelled speech?
On Friday, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decided that question, issuing a ruling partially upholding and partially vacating the preliminary injunction. In its ruling, the Ninth Circuit affirmed that NetChoice is likely to succeed in its claim that the California Age Appropriate Design Code Act requirement for businesses to, quote, opine on and mitigate the risk that children may be exposed to harmful or potentially harmful materials online facially violates the First Amendment, unquote. The court held that this requirement imposes a substantial burden on free speech by compelling businesses to engage in subjective assessments of content they host. Specifically, the court emphasized that the law's Data Protection Impact Assessment, or DPIA, requirement, quote, compels speech by requiring covered businesses to opine on potential harm to children and is thus subject to strict scrutiny under the First Amendment, which the court says it is likely to fail. The court says the DPIA requirement, quote, deputizes covered businesses into serving as censors for the state. But the court vacated parts of the district court's preliminary injunction that enjoined the entire Age Appropriate Design Code Act. The court found that it was, quote, too early to determine whether the unconstitutional provisions of the California Age Appropriate Design Code Act were likely severable from its valid remainder, unquote, and remanded the case for further proceedings on these issues. Now, the district court will reevaluate the remaining portions of the act under the framework provided by the Ninth Circuit opinion. The district court must determine whether these provisions can stand independently without the DPIA requirements and whether NetChoice is likely to succeed on its claims against these other provisions. NetChoice hailed the ruling, calling it a victory for free expression, online security, and Californian families. Chris Marchese, director of the NetChoice Litigation Center, said in a press statement that, quote, the court recognized that California's government cannot commandeer private businesses to censor lawful content online or to restrict access to it, unquote. But California officials also claimed success in their own statement issued late in the day. Governor Gavin Newsom said that, quote, California enacted this nation-leading law to shield kids from predatory practices Instead of adopting these common sense protections, NetChoice chose to sue. Yet today, the court largely sided with us. And California Attorney General Robert Bonta said, quote, "We're pleased that the Ninth Circuit reversed the majority of the district court's injunction," unquote. Before the court issued its ruling on Friday, Tech Policy Press fellow Dean Jackson spoke with Mitali Jain, executive director of the Tech Justice Law Project, and Ravi Iyer, the managing director of the USC Marshall School's Neely Center and a former data scientist at Meta. Their conversation touched on key points in the oral arguments around NetChoice v. Bonta and on the concept of design codes more generally. Here's Dean.
Hi, everybody. It's Dean here again. Mitali, Ravi, welcome. To start, I wanted to ask you, Mitali, about the oral arguments in the Bonta v. NetChoice case over the CAA-DCA. Can you just give us an overview of the potential legal consequences of that case?
Sure. The hearing in the NetChoice v. Bonta case occurred just a couple weeks after the Supreme Court delivered judgment in the other NetChoice cases, the content moderation laws that had come up from Texas and Florida, otherwise known as the NetChoice v. Moody and Paxton cases. And that turned out to be fairly significant for the NetChoice v. Bonta, the panel that was presiding over the oral arguments. And I guess what I would say as a general matter is that the 20-minute hearing, or the 20 minutes on each side, really was consumed by a battle of standards. It felt like the court was really grappling with the right legal standards to apply to really analyze the constitutionality of this bill. And it wasn't entirely clear in the first instance which of those standards should take prominence and how they should interact with each other. And so the three kind of standards that I heard them grappling with was, number one, when you have an industry tech association like NetChoice, bringing a lawsuit before the law has even come into effect, otherwise known as a facial challenge, how do you gauge whether the law is unconstitutional, given that it could have multiple applications? The standard that's operative is that the challenge has to show that there would be more unconstitutional applications than constitutional applications. But that's a very fact-intensive inquiry. And the court was really grappling with how to think about that standard, given that the facts were really quite geared towards only certain applications of the age-appropriate design code. So that was the first standard that they were grappling with. The second was, of course, the First Amendment, and looking at what level of scrutiny applied to the provisions of this law. Was it strict scrutiny? Was it something less? Was content being implicated directly by the provisions, content moderation, or was it something content adjacent or agnostic, which would mean that a different standard presumably would apply? And then the third standard that they were looking at was severability. So if, for example, they found that one portion of the statute was unconstitutional in all of its applications, then what happens to the rest of the statute? Are they still able to opine on the rest of the statute, or do they then have to see whether the rest of the statute would also fall because it was so intrinsically tied to the first part that they deemed unconstitutional? And so I think that's the kind of battle of standards that was going on in that oral argument. It was admittedly a really short argument. I think many advocates in the space were hoping to get a kind of glimpse into how this panel was thinking about issues like safety by design and privacy by default, approaches to regulation that really have extended well beyond the age-appropriate design code into other models of regulation in other states, as Ravi will talk about, but also in future iterations, optimizations of the age-appropriate design code that have now been adopted in other states. That, I think, is what civil society writ large was hoping to hear. I don't think we heard a lot of that because there was this kind of grappling with what the appropriate standards were. And there was this really central focus by the panel on one portion of the statute, which was the Data Protection Impact Assessment, otherwise known as the DPIA. And the provisions that they focused on in the DPIA, so just to back up, what this provision does is it creates an obligation for companies that come within the scope of the regulation to do an assessment to see how their data management practices impact on kids and whether the way that they manage data of the kids is harmful to kids using a number of different indicators through content, through context, through conduct, through algorithms, through design, and through data privacy. And so the court really focused on those first few, I guess, prongs of the DPIA, which were looking at data management practices vis-a-vis content, context, and conduct, and was really struggling to see how those weren't content moderation and therefore implicating the highest level of First Amendment review and therefore potentially unconstitutional. And so that, I think, really was the gist of the Ninth Circuit's oral argument. You saw a lot of back and forth between the counsel for the AG and the panel on these points. And then, of course, between the AG counsel and NetChoice's counsel.
So you alluded to other segments of the law, which I agree didn't get much airtime in the hearing, which did mostly focus on the DPIA. But I wanted to maybe back up a bit and ask, what other parts of the law are there? What other provisions of this law are there that might be severed if part of it does fail a First Amendment challenge, or that the judges might have focused on if they had chosen to talk more about safety by design?
Sure. So the Age-Appropriate Design Code is kind of, it works like a framework. And so the DPIA is kind of the first obligation that's put on companies to try to gauge what the current state of their practices is doing or not doing to harm kids. That then leads to certain kinds of mitigations that they're supposed to put into operation. But separate from that, there's also a series of privacy by default settings that they're meant to impose. And this would be high levels of privacy based on the fact that the user is a minor under the age of 18. That really seeks to underscore the fact that because of their minor status, that the data collection and use of the platforms should be minimal, kind of data minimization at its core. Separately, there's a series of prohibitions that have to do with design features and making sure that certain features that have long been understood to extend the time spent on platforms by kids or to be manipulative in any way, that those are prohibited from in the design of the platform itself. And so those are separate features of the statute that operate somewhat independently of the DPIA. But what you saw the court really struggling with was the argument that was really being advanced by NetChoice's counsel that if the DPIA falls, it all falls because it's all kind of intermingled and intrinsically tied to one another.
Robbie, for me to turn to you, it's about this concept of design codes, which you've done a lot of work on. And again, just to rephrase for the audience, it's this idea that there are basic things about how platforms work, like the ability to message unlimited strangers or the concepts of dark patterns and infinite scroll that keep, you know, on platform and engaging with content, sometimes maybe for longer than you want to or should be, that those types of things might be better handles for controlling various types of online harms than what we think of as of frontline content moderation, the sort of removal and flagging of individual posts. And your work on design codes isn't limited to kids' online safety. So I wanted to ask you maybe to take a step back and tell us, what are some other use cases for design codes? And maybe you could also talk a little bit about whether or not you're worried that cases like Bonta v. NetChoice might complicate the effort to promote them.
So I'd say that at its core, design codes are about empowering users. And I think the lowest hanging fruit in these systems is really about a duty of loyalty that these products ought to have to the consumers who are using them. 70% of kids think that they're being manipulated by these products to spend more time than they want to. But this sort of empowerment is not just specific to kids. So, a lot of kids are seeing content, sexually explicit content, for example, that they actually aren't looking for. Instagram's done research, for example, that in a 7-day period, 19% of kids are saying that they're seeing sexually explicit content that they don't want to. But if you actually survey adults, most adults are also seeing content that they don't want to see. A lot of times it's divisive content. A lot of times that divisive content is the stuff that gets implicated in research on polarization. And so the same things that protect kids also protect women. They protect journalists. They protect our democracy. And so these design choices, things like rate limiting, things like helping people avoid unwanted content, have definitely have implications for kids, but they also have implications for all the other harms that people associate with social media. So yes, I think kid safety is super important, and we should 100% start there, right? That's, I think, as a society, we all agree on that. But hopefully the decisions that are being made in these legal cases, the implications will also draw lines for other kinds of legislation that are being thought about to protect women online. Especially, we have a female candidate for president. I don't think Kamala Harris cares necessarily as much about the things that are being said about her, but all the stuff that's being said about her has implications for women's participation in politics in general, right? And so I think the same things that protect kids from being contacted a lot by strangers that sort of limit that would also protect the small group, protect women against the small groups of users who are trying to limit their participation by engaging in these kinds of discourse hyperactively. So yeah, I am really worried about the implications of this case. What I'm really interested in is what kinds of design are constitutional, what kinds of design are not constitutional, so that we can start to draw lines so that those of us working on legislation can have the clarity we need to design good legislation.
And do you have any sort of favorite examples of other design code choices? I think the ones that we've gravitated to in this and other conversations have focused a lot on various forms of online safety, but theoretically you could apply a design code to any range of content moderation issues. And I'm curious if you have kind of other examples that have been talked less about in other contexts.
My favorite examples are examples that I talk about periodically. So I don't know if they'll be new or not new to listeners, but I often talk about rate limits because I think the rhetoric of the platforms is that they're democratic. If you actually look at the stats, it's a small group of people who are dominating conversations. And then the second one I often talk about is just algorithms. And I think there's a confusion between what people want and what people engage with, that platforms often say, we're giving you what you want. And I think we all know there are things that we will consume, engage with, that we know are not good for us. And there's a difference between catering to what I explicitly want, what I aspire to consume, versus what I will pay attention to. And so I think those are just two obvious design choices that platforms, they could make themselves more democratic and they could listen to what people aspire to consume as opposed to what they pay attention to, that would empower consumers and would reduce a lot of harm.
I'd add one more example, which interestingly was back-to-back hearing, back-to-back with the NetChoice v. Bonta hearing, which was the X v. Bonta case. And regardless of what one may think about that particular law that mandated transparency in California for social media platforms in regards to their content moderation policies and practices, I think the broader issue of transparency, you know, fundamentally can be seen as a design issue, and how we design the ability to regulate transparency, to offer some sort of look in to a black box. And again, from a consumer empowerment perspective, provide information that ultimately helps consumers make decisions about what platforms they choose to frequent.
Just to put a point on that, like, we recently passed a law in Minnesota that had a lot of transparency provisions. And one of those provisions is actually giving people some visibility into how democratic these platforms actually are. What is the 50th percentile for, what does the median user do in terms of comments? And what is the 99th percentile? And I think we will see that the 99th percentile of users is making a ton more comments than your average person. And they are tend to dominate a conversation. And I think that changes how you view these platforms when you see that some of these things are not, I'm not seeing what people think. I'm seeing what a tiny group of people think or who are hyperactive on these platforms. And maybe I actually would love to engage in a service that was actually more democratic. I think transparency, the original ruling in this case might be interpreted as all transparency is unconstitutional, which I think is dangerous and flies in the face of a lot of legislation that has nothing to do with online speech. And so I'm hopeful that we can draw a better line so that those of us who are concerned about transparency, and so we understand like these products that we're engaging with better, we can design legislation that feels on firmer ground there too.
I just want to run this past both of you. Is there a metaphor here to be drawn to food safety, or is that too simple? Because in food safety, I might be compelled to eat a lot of potato chips. I know they're bad for me. I know exactly how bad for me they are because companies are required to give me nutrition information. And there are things they're not allowed to put in them. You can't sell poison to the public grocery store. And so I might aspire to eat healthier. Sometimes I might fall short of that, but companies are required to at least give me the tools to make those judgments. And there is a sort of floor on how unhealthy food is supposed to be able to be. And we don't seem to think of that as any kind of speech issue, right? No one's speech rights seem to be implicated in that regulatory scheme. Is that too simple an illusion, or are those parallels basically right?
I mean, I love the food safety analogy, and I sometimes make it. A lot of people who want to regulate tech use the tobacco analogy, and I actually think food's a little better analogy myself, in part because I think people should be able to use these products. I think they do have some benefits in the sense that like tobacco is, I'm not a smoker, so maybe people could talk about the benefits of tobacco, but I do eat a cheeseburger every so often. I'm an adult. I can eat a cheeseburger every so often. But I also think food safety also gives you an interesting analogy for kids, right? I have three kids myself. We all know that they don't have a lot of self-control, right? We don't let kids order whatever they want on the menu and eat as much of it as they want because they are still developing enough self-control to decide what is good for them and what is not good for them and think about the long term versus the short term. So I, as an adult, can be offered candy. And I think we think of that very differently than offering my kids candy. And so I think food safety also has a good analogy there as far as what do we offer to kids? What do we offer to adults? When is it manipulative? At what age do we have the self-control necessary to? And how can we aid people who maybe need some help with their self-control, putting a little bit more friction in these products, for example, to help them make better decisions?
I think food safety is a great metaphor. I think there's actually a number of metaphors. Whether it's car safety, food safety, there's a number of metaphors from the analog world, from the real world, that one could say are applicable here. And certainly some of the amici that came into this case tried to suggest that this is really an exceptional situation in which there's this one industry that really has managed to evade any sort of regulatory oversight. But meanwhile, there's a number of industries, including food, including automobiles and others, that it's not controversial at this point that they are subject to regulatory oversight. I think the argument back that tech loves to make, the industry loves to make, is that somehow by virtue of being online, that everything is related to speech. Speech is the product, and therefore the First Amendment applies. And I think that's the question that Ravi alluded to, that we need to see if courts are going to be parsing that out with nuance to say, for example, functional design is different from expressive design. And we see that. We see that upstream safeguards on how platforms are designed can be a functional type of choice versus something that inherently is expressive. And that may have consequences downstream for content, but that's not at the point of intervention. We're struggling, I think, to really at this point understand whether courts are going to go there or not. Certainly the Supreme Court in its most recent spate of decisions suggested, or at least a couple of the justices suggested, that there might be some nuance in how they analyze the First Amendment in the future, in future cases. But again, I think only time will tell. And meanwhile, we don't really have a lot of time given how much harm has already ensued.
You've preempted somewhat my final question for both of you. I'll put myself in the position of playing devil's advocate, and then I want you to rebut me, essentially. Or you can agree with me if you want. I don't think you will. I think if I can paraphrase the argument that these functional design choices implicate speech, it would go something like, you can't set rules around how many or what type of messages someone can send children or other elements of platform design without some theory of what the harm is on the other side. There are these phrases about duty of care or best interests of the child that require some kind of judgment about what types of content children access and whether or not it's good for them. And so the whole, if we're going to stick with the upstream downstream analogy, the whole river is contaminated with speech concerns. I think that would be a fair summary of the counter argument about speech. Maybe we could close out with your reaction to that. How would you push back on that narrative or on that argument?
I'd start by saying that a lot of the harms that we are defining are not things that government necessarily needs to define. I think it's something that users themselves are defining. And so I think when users there is some sense of harm in all legislation that someone has to define. I think a lot of the design choices are not about duty of care, but they're actually around duty of loyalty. It's about what are the users saying is harmful to them, not what is the speech that we think is harmful to them. When kids are saying that they're seeing sexual content that they don't want to see, right? I think that they don't want to see part is really important. When they're getting advances that they don't want to get from others, right? I think that is where you can draw a line between speech, right? We're not talking about what we are saying people can say or not say. We're talking about what users are saying, the experiences that they are having and what they want and what they don't want. And I think that's a clear distinction between what design can do. It's not saying like you can or cannot say things. It's saying that you are doing things that your own users are saying are harmful and we don't want you to keep doing that.
Yeah, I think I would agree with Ravi. And this is where I think it's going to also be important as we move forward to see how courts consider these duties of loyalty and whether they withstand constitutional scrutiny. Because not only is it a mechanism both for kind of user choice to come in and for that to inform the design choices that platforms make, but it also allows for a duty that extends beyond some of the current harms that we've heard about in the political or public discourse, right? It's alive to the fact that we've seen a certain category of harms, but there may be others, and that we need to also make sure that any regulation that's adopted can withstand the test of time and not be obsolete before it's even in force.
Thank you so much, Vitaly. Thank you, Ravi.
Nice to be here, Dean. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks, Dean. Glad to be here.
That's it for this episode. I hope you'll send your feedback. You can write to me at justin@techpolicy.press. Thanks to my guests, thanks to my co-founder, Brian Jones, and thank you for listening.
Tech Policy Press.